Did you know the largest and most intense tropical cyclone on record was Typhoon Tip? It occurred in 1979 in the Western Pacific, with a diameter of 2,220 kilometers, 1,779 miles. It was nearly half the size of the United States. The storm was so violent it caused a Chinese ship to break in half. We'll discuss this and other interesting facts about natural disasters and their impact on us with documentarian George Siegel on this episode of The Curious Professor. Everyone, I'm Dr. B. Welcome to the Curious Professor podcast, where I take listeners on a journey of discovery to explore the people, places, artifacts, and natural wonders that spark my curiosity. On this episode of the Curious Professor podcast, we'll explore documentary filmmaking with George Siegel. But first, a trivia question. What's the difference between a hurricane, a cyclone, and a typhoon? I'll have the answer for you at the end of this episode. I'm thrilled to have George Siegel on the show today. George began his career in front of the camera as a newscaster, sportscaster, and weathercaster. He worked in markets from Los Angeles to San Francisco, Seattle, Detroit, and San Antonio, Texas. In addition to work in front of the camera, George was a feature reporter and producer. In 2001, he formed JEL Productions, a video production company that produces commercials, infomercials, television programs, and documentary films. The company also created their own original programming, which included a Texas travel program and a building and remodeling show. George is most proud of his latest venture, forming the documentary film company Move the World Films. He wrote, directed, and produced the award-winning documentary films The Last House Standing and License to Parent. George, his wife Nancy, and their children live in Tampa, Florida. When I learned about George's fascinating documentary films, my curiosity was immediately piqued and I wanted to learn more. I hope this interview with George will spark your curiosity too. Welcome to the show, George. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I appreciate you having me on.
What got you interested in making documentaries?
Well, I was looking for a way to tell stories that, you know, you don't need the whole Hollywood theatrical production where you're telling a story off of a script. A documentary, you're kind of covering a topic. So you go out there and if you don't have an agenda going into it, you let the story tell itself and you come up with a story that you think will be compelling for people to listen to. And in the end, you hope that's what you get, a film that people want to watch and that might be able to actually make a difference.
And tell us about the mission of Move the World Films.
Well, Move the World Films, the idea was to try to move the world one film at a time, is to try to make films that, like I said, can make a difference. You know, I see a lot of documentary. There's so many great documentary filmmakers out there. And some of them are for a cause. Some of them are for just to get your emotions. I like to make ones that I hope could actually change something or do something. And I try to do it in a way that my personal beliefs aren't thrust on people, but rather the situation tells a story, and then you're able to determine if that's something that you believe in or don't believe in.
And how long have you been working in the documentary space?
You know, I've been doing documentaries for about, gosh, I think about 5 years, 5 or 6 years. Before that, I was just doing video production. And before that, I was on in front of the camera as a weathercaster and a sportscaster and a show host and an anchor and all that fun stuff in the news business.
So what led to the transition for you to go from on camera to behind the camera?
There's a lot of BS involved when you're in front of the camera. First, you always have to look good. People notice you when you're out, if you're on air. So you always have to be on your game. You know, you always have to, you represent the company that you're working for. I'm a kind of a private person in that that's probably what I enjoyed least about that. I liked the money the most, but having to always be on and then having to suck up to management that clearly, if you watch the news, you know what their agenda is. And that's just wasn't for me. You know, I don't mind when you make a film, you're beholden to people, obviously, in some level that contribute money to your film. But it's different because they're investing in you or backing you. When you're a personality on a station, they own you. And you see it happen. People get canceled all the time for things, something stupid you did, something stupid you said, something. It's just there's just a lot of things involved there. And like I say, I miss the money from the business because if you make it to a good market, you get paid pretty well. But I don't miss all the stuff that went with that.
In your most recent documentary, The Last House Standing, you discuss the urgent need for those living in disaster-prone areas to build or fortify their homes to withstand the wrath of Mother Nature. Tell us what inspired you to make that documentary.
Well, when I was in the news business, a lot of times we would cover stories about people who were victims of a disaster, whether it was flooding or fire, tornadoes, hurricanes. And it's the same story every time. It's a tragic story of people not thinking that it would happen to them. And then all of a sudden, they're in a situation where they've lost everything and they're having to rebuild and start their lives over. And I thought that this doesn't have to be this way. Why do we keep making the same mistakes over and over and over again? What can we do to change that? And obviously, the best thing to do would be tougher building codes. And from the top, having them say, look, you can't build there. It's dangerous. You can't do this. You can't do that. That's somewhat a bit of government control that probably people wouldn't go for. Although in other countries, they do that. One of the gentlemen in our film, Henk Ovink from the Netherlands, they move people if they're in an area that continues to flood. And they tell you, you have to relocate. You can't keep building there because it's not safe. So you look at our country, people can pretty much live wherever they want if it's zoned properly. So as a result, we're living in risky areas that are vulnerable to storms, but we don't build in a way that can survive those storms. And that's just mind-boggling to me, why people do that. I was with some people earlier today, and I can see here in their mentality, they were talking about, oh, I have these problems at my house, but I'm not going to fix them yet because they're not bad enough. And it's like, okay, you know your vulnerabilities, you know what conceivably could happen. Now you're taking a chance, and we see every year that people pay for it, whether the worst scenario is loss of life, and then losing your property and losing everything you have is such a traumatic thing for people. It can take them years, if not forever, to regain their footing and go on. And I wanted to make a film that would wake people up. And we're not trying to wake them up from the top, although that would be nice. I think that's an impossible task to do for a filmmaker. But if individuals start listening, if people start taking heed and saying, okay, I can do these things and I can save my own skin, I can protect myself, I think it can make a difference.
And what was the most important thing you feel you learned from making the film?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, we've got to demand more from builders. We have to stop letting them build things that aren't that great, and then we just take them over, and then it becomes our problem. And that goes with existing houses, too. You know, I live in Florida, and the housing market here is really tight. In other words, you put a house on the market, they'll get five offers right away. So if you're going to be the noble person and go, that house isn't safe, that's garbage, the next person will just buy it. So it's tough to do that now. So you really have to have that home inspected and find out what the vulnerabilities are, and then determine whether you're going to be okay living with that. Am I willing to accept the risk? I know a lot of people here that buy houses that are at sea level or 1 or 2 feet up, and the flood level here is 10 feet. So you know when you buy that house that you need to understand if there's a storm surge, your house will flood and you likely will have to rebuild it. If it's worth the risk to you, then you take that risk. The other thing I learned is that people really need to understand their insurance policy, what their coverage is, you know, what they're covered for, and how they would do after a disaster. Because a lot of people have insurance, but they don't realize, wow, I need flood insurance. Because if my house floods, my insurance policy is not going to pay for it. And the thing I always tell people about insurance companies, in my opinion, it's like the money windows at Las Vegas. There's a lot of places you can buy chips. There's very few places you can cash them in. Insurance companies do not like giving money back to us. It's our money now. And so you really have to be organized. So if you have to file a claim, you make it easy for them to pay you. And that means inventorying everything in your house, being able to prove to them what you have, understanding your coverage so you know what you can get back, and being a bulldog to go get it. Because it's tough. These people that have disasters, you're so shell-shocked by what just happened to you. That's not the time to get organized. The time to get organized is on the sunny day when there's nothing going on.
What do you feel like was your biggest challenge in making the documentary?
I would say the biggest challenge was getting all the people to be in it. It took a long time. You know, to get the FEMA director took almost a year to get Hank Ovink, because he's such a busy man, took forever. It took well over a year to get him. And FEMA normally doesn't want to talk to filmmakers. And I'm sure we could all appreciate why. They catch so much grief. Overall, I think they do a great job. But they want to switch the conversation to being proactive for disasters, not reactive. So they were interested in being in our film because of that. We weren't trying to show anything bad about them. We're trying to show that we can be a support in that if people watched our film and did what was in there that we say to do, FEMA's job would be easier. Insurance companies' jobs would be easier. So it was getting people. It takes a lot of time. And also when you're a smaller crew with a smaller budget, when you go to cover a story, you really have to get it right. You can't go fly someplace to interview somebody and have them be a dud, or you're trying to get stories from people that have had tragedy and you're trying to get to them and talk to them. And you have to do it a lot of times that you have to work with their schedule. But so there's a lot of little pieces that are involved that make it challenging. But when you're done, it's very rewarding. It's just it's an effort to get there.
So you live in Florida, as you've mentioned. Tell us how you've prepared your family and your home for natural disasters.
Well, we have a concrete house on both floors. We have a generator. I cut the trees back. I understand what the risks are going into a storm. I know, make sure we have the right food and everything. So if it got hard to go to stores, if things were in short supply, we would be okay. And I make sure that I have all my stuff inventoried. You know, you walk around your house with your cell phone and take pictures and leave it in the cloud. So, you know, God forbid something happened, we would be ahead of the game in making a claim. Now, all things go out the window sometimes because a tree falls on your house if there's a storm, or there could be a fire. There's a lot of things that can change. But if you do the preparation and do all the little stuff, it hopefully puts you in a better position if something worse happens.
Let's talk a little bit about your first documentary, License to Parent. That focuses on the lack of requirements needed for parenting. What inspired you to make that film?
Well, I have 5 kids, and I think if I had to take a test to show whether I was qualified to be a parent, I don't know that they would have given them to me. I think there's a lot of people that have children that probably shouldn't be parents. Our film's not, you know, a lot of people get angry and they go, we can't license parents. That's illegal. It's not constitutional. That's not what we're suggesting in the film. What we're suggesting is parenting is the most important job in the world and maybe needs to be given a little more thought. And people are just capable of reproducing. Doesn't mean they should. And there's a lot of crappy parents out there. There's a lot of parents that don't realize if you send a bad kid out into the world. People, again, in our country, everybody has their rights. They have their individual rights. If you could keep your kids on a compound and never let them into society, then maybe your rights go a little further than what you normally think. But once those little miscreants go wandering out into the world and they're affecting other people, there's a cost to society. There's a responsibility you have as a parent to try to raise the best child possible to put out into the world. And I don't know that as a country, we don't have enough support for parents. Most states don't have educational programs or daycare, or things that could really help parents be better at their job. And then there's always people, you know, you said you didn't have kids, and I know a lot of people that don't have kids, and sometimes the way they look at a mother with a crying baby, and I'm not saying you by any means, but you know, you're in a restaurant and the child's crying. In most cases, the parent feels as bad as you do. And are they trying to solve that problem so it doesn't become your problem? And I just think that sometimes a smile and a, hey, it's okay, just a nice word to a parent can make a huge difference in the day, because it's a tough job. And now imagine a mom or dad that have 1 or 2 jobs, kids are in school now with COVID. I mean, parents have a lot of things coming at them, and I don't think we give them enough credit. I don't think we give them enough blame when things go badly, but we need to give them support, which I think is the most important thing.
You said that you believe if we can raise the standard of parenting, we can make the world a better place in which to live. Tell us more about that.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, just, gosh, you see stories in the news all the time of kids that go out and do stupid things. You know, there was a story here a few years ago of kids that were drag racing during the day. They hit a mom walking across the street and her baby in a stroller. You hear about drunk driving accidents, kids getting in trouble, you know, different things that they do. There's so many things coming at children that if parents could really be better at their job, and it's tough because if you were to sit there and analyze my situation, I'm not claiming to be perfect. And I think if I have any strength as a parent, it's that another parent could sit down and talk to me and go, hey, did you know what your kid was doing? And I would want to hear what they're telling me. And then I would want to talk about it and go, okay, what can I do to correct that behavior? And I think that's the way parents need to be. I've had some parents a few years ago, one of my son's friends hit him. And I called the mom to tell her that. And she went ballistic. Like, her kid never would do anything wrong. How dare you criticize my child? It's like, whoa, pump the brakes here. It happened. We know it happened. That's not the issue. I'm just letting you know. She never spoke to us again. The reality is, parents should be open to that. If there's conflicts with children, with bullying or whatever, parents should be able to talk to other parents and say, let's stop this. You know, bullying is a horrible thing that children go through, and it leads to suicide or eating disorders, all kinds of problems. And no child should have to experience that. And so parents collectively should want to say, hey, if my kid's the bully, I need to figure out what's going on. I'm going to stop that. And so I think if parents collectively all did a better job, yeah, I think society would be a lot better.
So that old saying of it takes a village really isn't the case anymore.
I've heard that expression a lot, and I think it takes, I think we all have to support each other. And that doesn't mean heavily funded programs and, you know, mandated things. And it's just, there's an attitude, a support. You know, in some states, they have programs that give parents classes that teach them and answer questions. Maybe instead of the hospital just being concerned how you strap the car seat in when you're leaving, they give you material that might actually help you do a better job raising that child. It can be approached from a number of different ways, but it can be better than it is right now, because I don't think, like, well, each kid I left the hospital with, I think by the fifth one, they didn't even come out to see if the car seat was strapped in right. But that used to be the big thing. Make sure that car seat's in correctly. Well, maybe that's not my biggest problem, although it's a problem. You know, maybe I'm just incompetent and shouldn't have children.
Well, and I think maybe we have lost our sense of community that we had in previous eras.
That could be a safe thing to say. I mean, everything now is so divided and so political. And so, you know, it needs to get back to just people being people and not fighting over, you know, what you believe in or what I believe in. You know, I have some friends, we might be polar opposites on what we believe in, but we're still friends after having a conversation. It doesn't have to turn into a major deal. And that could be the same for supporting people with children. You know, it's just do it with positivity instead of negativity. I think it can be done.
Well, and they say that there was a change in our societal structure when they moved from a building houses with front porches to building houses with back porches, so that people don't congregate in their communities like they used to when everyone had front porches and all the kids would be out playing together and there was a greater sense of community. Now we just drive into our garage, close the door, and isolate ourselves in our back porch, and we don't have that neighborly sense of community that we used to have.
I would agree with that. And also, kids sitting inside on electronic devices, not engaging face to face with people. You know, my kids tell me, well, Dad, if you had that when you were our age, you would have played with this too. And I said, I don't think so. We liked going out and playing sports and hanging out and doing things. And it's easy to say, you know, sure, maybe they're right. Maybe we would be a little electronic junkies too. But I like to think we wouldn't. And I think those days were better in the sense of getting out and being around people. I don't think you get the same experience sitting inside playing on an Xbox.
So are there any documentaries right now that you've been watching that you thought were outstanding that you would recommend that other people view? Of course, other than your own documentaries.
Well, I would start with mine. I would go to thelasthousestanding.org and watch my film first. But there's a lot of great films out there. You know, some of the ones, and of course the names are going to escape me because I didn't think about this in advance. You know, some of them I watch afterwards that I've seen lately, the heavily promoted ones that are on Netflix or Hulu or whatever. And I'm annoyed by the agenda that they have. You know, you can tell if it's a Republican film or a Democratic film based on how they go after people and how they edit it. And I just am not as big a fan of that. I'll watch just to see what's going on. But in the end, I want a story that allows me to think and doesn't shove a position down my face. And like I said, some names are escaping me, but there's, you know, I'm in a documentary film group with eight other filmmakers, and we meet every couple of weeks and talk about our projects. And if I look at each one of their films, they're all fantastic films. They've all told a great story and had a great idea. And that's just a small percentage of filmmakers. I mean, there's probably thousands and thousands of films that come out every year. So it's just a matter of finding what you like, Googling it, and then going to watch it. And you know, you shouldn't feel bad about renting a film not so much on the Netflix or Amazon platform, but if there's if a filmmaker has a website or a way that you can watch it, because most of us are underfunded. You know, most of us scrape together just to be able to make our films. And so when somebody goes and spends $3.99 or $4.99 to rent that film, that's supporting that filmmaker. And I think that's a good thing to do. But there's so many. I'm sorry, I don't have any specific names.
So what's up next for you? What are your plans for future documentaries?
You know, I've got a couple of ideas, things I'm working on. One is continuing the theme of The Last House Standing and what the cost is of rebuilding. Another film I'm looking at is about families and how that so many of them just fall apart, whether it's through the death of a parent, that when there's that leadership vacuum in a family, siblings fighting over stuff. And it happens whether you're a wealthy family or a poor family, you're just fighting over different stuff. I'm exploring, you know, the challenge raising money to do those kind of projects. But I think that would be a really interesting film because so many families, most people I know have a dysfunctional family on some level. When I meet one that doesn't, I'm fascinated and I ask them a million questions. And the challenge of making a film like that is getting access to the dysfunctional ones, because the person in the family who's most dysfunctional is least likely to sit down and be interviewed and featured in a film.
Right. That could be a challenge.
That's a big challenge. And that's the tough thing in a film. I mean, you have to get somebody to sign a release, first of all, to be in it. But you could follow them around for 3 or 4 months, and then they could just say, nah, I don't want to do it. And yeah, you have 3 or 4 months worth of footage. But if you didn't get what you needed, you've wasted a lot of time and resources on getting that. So that's tough. I've watched some films. A great example, Ron Howard made a film, and he doesn't need my plug because it was on Netflix or something. It was Paradise is Burning, or Rebuilding Paradise. And it was about Paradise, California, and how people's lives a year after, and how that year was recovering from this tragedy. And I'm a big fan of his, but I could see where he had a budget that we didn't, because he followed all these people around for a year. And, you know, you're going to get some hits and misses in doing that. But you see these stories about how people, how their lives were changed, families that would get divorced, people that had to move, people that tried to rebuild. And it was a really fascinating look at that. But that's an example of a bigger budget project you can do versus a smaller one. If I followed 10 people around, that would be very challenging to do. You have to have a bigger crew.
Or unlimited funding.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we had a small crew. I mean, there's like 4 or 5 people that were the core working on our film. And they were all really talented, and things that I didn't do well, they did well. And we were all a good team that got the most out of each other.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell us about you or your work?
I just, you know, you can't tell people enough to watch the film. And when I say, you know, check our website, thelasthousestanding.org, because it is showing up on public television stations around the country. So if you said, I don't want to pay $3.99 for this guy's film, you can watch it for free in a lot of markets around the country as they roll out. But the most important thing is the resources page on our website. Go to that page. It links you to FEMA. You could see what kind of flood area you live in. You can see how you could prepare for disasters. And it's the mentality that most people have, we all live with it, is it's not going to happen to me. And most people, when you talk to, if they've been in a car accident or they've fallen hiking or their house is destroyed in a storm, they never said they woke up that day and thought that was going to happen. Hey, I think I'm going to go out and get in an accident today. No. Bad things happen. So why do you not want to be as prepared as possible? So for me, a victory for me would be a lot of people see this film and they actually do something, and we start demanding more. When I go on Zillow and see that rather than all the fluff and the crap in houses that nobody cares about, well, everybody cares about, but it's not going to keep you safe, that they start rewarding safe houses and put a big star up there. This house is a 5-star safety rating, like a car has a 5-star crash rating, and really put on a neon sign, these are safe houses. Then I'll feel a lot better and go, wow, we accomplished something, hopefully.
And did you want to mention the website for Move the World Films?
MoveTheWorldFilms.org. You know, that's just information about us. It's, you know, I think it links to both of our films. But, you know, the one I'd really like people to go to, especially now we're in hurricane season, fire season's coming up on the West Coast. They're already having fires out there. TheLastHouseStanding.org. Just check it out. If you see the film and you like it, feel free to leave a review. Email me a comment. Maybe you have some thoughts about it, something you think I could have done better. I've had people send me things and I go, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. As you know, anytime you do anything over the air or public, you're going to have people that like it and people that don't. And I respect both sides. If you want to, you know, if you want to tell me what you wish you had seen, I'd love to talk about it. So I would just encourage people to check it out.
That's wonderful. It was great to have you on the show, George. Thank you so much for taking time to be a guest on the Curious Professor podcast.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
And now for the answer to this episode's trivia question. What's the difference between a hurricane, a cyclone, and a typhoon? Giant tropical storms may be called hurricanes, cyclones, or typhoons, depending on where they occur. In the Atlantic Ocean and the Northeast Pacific, tropical cyclones are called hurricanes. In the Northwest Pacific, they are typhoons, and in the South Pacific and Indian Ocean, they're referred to as cyclones. We'll end the show with something punny. What's a tornado's favorite dance? The twist. Thank you for joining me for this episode of The Curious Professor Podcast. If there's a person, place, artifact, or natural wonder that has sparked your curiosity and you'd like for me to feature it on the show, please let me know. My website is thecuriousprofessorpodcast.com. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to subscribe to The Curious Professor Podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you'd like to become part of my community of curiosity seekers, be sure to visit my website, thecuriousprofessorpodcast.com, and join Dr. B's Hive. Until next time, always be learning and be curious with Dr. B.